Good morning, everyone. My name is Nick Stickland, and I am incredibly proud to be one of the trustees of this brilliant charity making this inspiring festival happen. This morning, I'm really delighted to introduce a man who has led expeditions from the first descent of the Blue Nile to traversing the Darien Gap and even delivering a grand piano into the jungle. It's with utmost pleasure that I introduce the talk from utmost east to utmost west, my life of exploration and adventure. Please join me in welcoming Colonel John Blashford Snell.
One of my earliest expeditions was to the Blue Nile in Ethiopia in 1968. And this was carried out at the request of His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, the Emperor of Ethiopia. It was supported handsomely by the Ministry of Defense, and the area was one that was just almost totally unknown in 1968. And when you look at this map, you can see that the river rises in Lake Tana and flows down through a great gorge. The gorge goes for about 400 miles. It's a mile deep. There are many unmapped areas, huge rapids, lots of crocodiles, masses of hippo, and said to be radioactive landslides. There are also quite a few income tax rebels, as we discovered later, hiding out down there. With the backing of the army, we selected a team of some 60 soldiers and scientists, mostly from the Natural History Museum, and the expedition was to be carried out in two phases. Unfortunately, my laser won't work on this picture, but the first phase was from the Shafatak Bridge, where you see the road crossing the river, down to the plains of Sudan, and then we were to go to the top, to Lake Tana, and come down the second part of the river, where there were considerable rapids, and the conditions at that time of year were much worse. So we had to do it that way round because of the climate. We were also supported by the Daily Telegraph, very handsomely, and Survival Anglia Television. Now, when you are standing on the top of the gorge, you can't see the bottom on a cloudy day, and so much of it was unmapped. We had decided that we ought to use inflatable boats. Some people who tried to go down the river before and had been wrecked said they reckoned inflatables would bounce off the rocks. So we went to the Avon Company, who made yachting tenders, and said, could we borrow six? They looked a bit skeptical, but they lent them to us, and we took them to a weir in Wales and put them over 40 times, and we didn't manage to puncture them. So we coated these inflatable yachting tenders with extra layers of neoprene. We put big valves in, and inside the tubes, we put football bladders. So we had tubes within tubes. And the boats seemed to be, we hoped, unsinkable. We were very fortunate that the army also provided a Beaver aircraft from Netherhaven. And this was to fly out to Ethiopia from England and give us the support that we needed with rations and stores and fuel and so on. So in 1968, the expedition arrived in Ethiopia and went to a small town called Debra Marcos in central Ethiopia. And when we arrived there, there was a rebellion going on. And that's a view of our camp from the air. So we built a fence around it called a zareba of thorns. It was highly effective, except that I found small boys able to climb over it. So I don't think it was going to do much defense for us. The rebels went on having their problem with the local government, and as you will hear, we ran into difficulty with them much later. And so we started from the bridge at Shafatak with four Royal Engineer assault boats. These had been modified by Prince Philip, who'd advised us on the boats and so on for the expedition. He came with the Queen to see the boat, the expedition set off before it left England. Unfortunately, engines at the back, although they were quite powerful, did not have enough power to drive us back upriver. So there was only one way to go, and that was forward. And that shows you the view now as we set off down the river. And the first thing, of course, was to get supplies, and this is where the Beaver aircraft came in. And I'll now show you a clip of film of this.
The expedition now urgently needed fresh food. So the signalers cranked up the generator for the radio transmitter to call up the Beaver aircraft for a pinpoint supply drop. Meantime, Blashford Snell wrote his shopping list, and soon deliveries were on the way. The first red supply chute dropped slap to the beach from 1,000 feet up. The next two came down through low cloud. They were only a few yards off target among the trees. Aerial delivery may be a splendid way to get your fresh fruit and groceries. But the parachute failed to break the fall of some of the containers sufficiently, so the pots and pans didn't arrive in very good shape. A panel beater's hammer is an essential part of every aerial shopper's kit.
When it came to our food, the rations we started out using were the SAS ration pack. This was designed to last a person 24 hours and give them 3,500 calories. There were various tasteless items in it, but in fact, the key thing that you can see there is the sardine tin, because all British soldiers were taught on no account should you attempt to open the sardine tin with the tin opener provided, because if you do, you will probably lose a finger. And what you should do is to take your revolver and blow a hole in the top of the sardine tin, and into that you should put some fluff. Where do I get fluff from on an expedition? Well, the answer is if you're wearing your socks, woolen, grey, Army Mark I, you will find that over a period of weeks of marching, the fluff from your socks will work its way up your legs. And with that, you can make a wick, which you can put into the hole in the center of the sardine tin, and you make a lamp, which when it's red hot, all the solder around the edge of the tin melts. You can flip it off and you can eat 6 perfectly cooked sardines. I've never wanted to eat another SAS ration pack. We then met some of the local people. In fact, they were trying to ambush us, but we ambushed them. And we took them prisoner, and we didn't want to be too nasty to them. So we took away all their ammunition, and we pulled out the bullets of their cartridges, emptied the powder out, put the bullets back in, handed them back, and then we gave them a Mars bar and sent them on their way. But there were lots of well-known bandits in the area. The scientists who'd come with us were hard at work. There were lots of fascinating creatures, including this particular bat, and all sorts of creepy crawlies, snakes and bugs. And so the scientists from the Natural History Museum really had an absolute field day. But now we come to the bit that I'm going to concentrate on, which is the second phase, going up to the Lake Tana. And there we were to launch our white water boats. And these were named Faith, Hope and Charity. And there were three men in each, and they had inflatable tubes and inside with zips on, so you could open the zip and you could put things like microscopes and cameras and so on inside the tubes. And with that, we would head off downriver. We had a bank support group coming along the sides to help if necessary. But you've got to remember, no one had ever tried doing this before. We had no experience. We tried paddling around in a Welsh river, and that was about it. So we were really inventing whitewater rafting by accident. However, the expedition started and we hit some of the big rapids, and I'll now show you a clip of film of that.
Some of the smaller chutes were successful, but again, the hazard was a question of getting out of control and losing the rope, which would mean that we weren't ready to enter the cataract below. Before we went into the cataracts, Roger always used to get us to come into the bank to try and observe a good route into the white water ahead. Sometimes we could do this with success and find a suitable entry into a cataract. Sometimes we couldn't. And obviously the rougher the ride was when we were not sure of the best route into the cataract. I think the most terrifying thing of all, though, was the volume of noise and the fact that whenever a boat went into a cataract, those of us behind would just see it disappear over the lip. And it wouldn't reappear, and one would wonder what on earth had happened to them.
Edwards nearly drowned when he was held under time after time before a lifeline reached him.
The most terrifying aspect of it was this frightful business of being continually dragged down into the bottom of the riverbed, being forced then by the water up to the surface, and then thinking that you're going to be all right, but suddenly the same force dragging you back down and tumbling you around and just spinning and turning, and not having any control whatsoever over your limbs or movement, and eventually beginning to realize that you were drowning. Then coming up to the surface once again, thinking and looking around, trying to see if anyone else was there, being dragged down, and going through the same process about three or four times, and each time getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and believing that this was the end of the Blue Nile expedition as far as you were concerned. And then terrific relief, of course, when eventually the river did release you.
Jim Masters had several narrow escapes too.
There were several emotions as we saw cataracts ahead. Of course, the big thing was a tremendous volume of noise. But there was always a very fast, smooth stretch of water leading up to a cataract. And in that time, you were absolutely petrified with fear. Mm. But of course, once you were in the cataract, you were far too busy trying to keep the boat straight to give yourselves a chance. And then at the end of the cataract, there was always this tremendous feeling of exhilaration. On one particular occasion, we were halfway down the cataract when I heard one of my crew members at the front shout out, "Look out, we're going." And with almost no warning, I found myself somewhere down on the bottom of the river. And it was like being shaken by a dog or being in a tumble spin dryer. You had absolutely no idea which was up and which was down. I remember on that occasion swimming like mad, but not really knowing whether I was coming to the top or not. Thank you.
Very, very sadly, at that point, whilst crossing a tributary to the main river, one of our soldiers, Corporal Ian MacLeod of the Black Watch and the SAS, was drowned. But nevertheless, the expedition pressed on. And then we met the income tax rebels. And they explained that they had no quarrel with us, but they thought if they made us hostage, then Haile Selassie would wipe out their income tax. We told them they were totally mistaken, but that was doing no good. So there we were, being held hostage by these quite charming gentlemen, really. They actually allowed us to keep our guns, which was understandable. And while we were being held by them, to our amazement, a policeman arrived. He'd come down from the local village, thanks to getting a lift in an American helicopter, and he came up to try to sort out the problem with the locals. And when he was leaving, as he was walking up the hill, I was just behind him, he turned to me very quietly, and he said in perfect English, "Keep your guns beside you in the morning. Do whatever you have to do normally. I expect that the villagers won't wake up in time. So jump into your boats and go like hell down the river." I said, "Where did you learn to speak English?" And she said, "Hendon Police College." And so it was next morning. That's exactly what we did. And we sped down river before they could wake up. And we came into this extraordinary gorge with vertical cliffs, which was absolutely fascinating. But of course, there's no way to get out of it except by keeping going on down the river. And then we spotted two enormous cave entrances. Well, we've been told this story about a legendary lost city belonging to the Queen of Sheba. And our archaeologists were extremely keen to investigate. But how did you get into that cave? Well, we had one or two boats which had small motors. So we brought one boat up against the cliff face, and Chris Bonington, who was a young climber in those days, was working for the Daily Telegraph as a photographer. He jumped from the boat onto the cliff face and up into the cliff, where they found it wasn't a tunnel leading into a lost city, it was just a cave. But it was full of some fascinating artifacts, which of course the archaeologists got very excited about. Well, whilst all this was going on, I was exploring the other side of the river. And this is a photograph taken later, looking down on the site. The cliff, the dark cliff there is where the caves are. And you see this inlet. Well, in this little inlet coming into the river, I'd spotted some copper deposits. So I went up to investigate. And while I was looking at the copper deposits, there was a loud bang and a bullet hit the rock above my head. I looked up and there was a chap on top of the cliff with a rifle. So I shouted at him, "Hey, watch out, you might have hit me." And then I realized that's exactly what he was trying to do. So I ran down the inlet onto the beach and said to everyone who'd now come together for lunch, "Quick, grab a Mars bar." We had plenty of those. "Grab a Mars bar and let's get out of here." But as I did so, on the opposite cliff, about 30 gentlemen in white robes stood up, put up their rifles and began to fire into the camp. At the same time, another group of gentlemen behind us began to roll boulders down the cliff on top of us. And so this was a tricky moment. So I said to everyone, grab the Mars bars, get out of here fast. And I said to Joe, my helmsman, who was a Royal Navy midshipman, take our boat and go upriver and try and draw their fire. Very courageous thing to do. Anyway, as he did so, a chap appeared behind me and tried to shoot me. So I fired back at him, and I think I'd probably hit his rifle because it flew out of his hand, but he ran away. And then I grabbed what I had was a secret weapon. I had a loudhailer. And I switched it on and I called out to the leader of the people who were shooting at us, Tenasteling, Tenasteling, we are your friends. We come in peace. Would you like a Mars bar? And this chap took off his pith helmet. He was wearing a pith helmet as well. And he bowed down to me and I bowed to him. Then the wretched chap put his rifle up and he fired again and the bullet landed between my feet. So I realized there was no way of stopping it. And meanwhile, I realized, of course, I'd sent all the boats away, and except for myself, I was standing on the beach. So at that point, luckily, Joe came back downriver and shouted, get in, you fool, quick. And I waded out, carrying the only thing I could grab in time, which was a can of petrol. So I lost all these valuable artifacts, but I did save the petrol. I jumped into the boat, and we headed off downriver as fast as we could. But up ahead of us, we could see an ambush. There were more people standing there. The air was full of rocks and stones and spears and bullets. Chris Bonington got hit in the back with a stone and cracked a rib, but luckily the bullets missed us. And I realized that this ambush was waiting for us. So I turned to the zoologist, who luckily was a crack shot, and I said, return fire. And we opened fire with our revolvers, and that managed to drive these people away from the cliff's edge. And we then speeded off downriver as fast as we possibly could. After a few miles, we erected our radio and got through to base and said, do not start exciting the emperor, but we've been attacked by income tax rebels. And if you tell him about it, he'll be sending his fighter jets in to bomb everything. I'd rather be out of here first. And at this point, as I say, we were going splendidly. There was no sign of any problem. We went on downriver, and eventually in the afternoon, we came to this island. And we decided that we ought to stop there because up in front of us was an enormous rapid that I wanted to do carefully in full daylight. So we built a little camp in the middle of the island. We put a fence around it of thorns, and we were sitting there having a cup of tea when three young men, Ethiopians, swam across the river. They were stark naked, wearing nothing but a Coptic cross. They swam over to us, and we noticed that they took a considerable interest in our firearms. So they were obviously a recce party. So nevertheless, we gave them a Mars bar and we sent them away. But that night we put two sentries on and we were all in bed except for the sentries. I was in a deep sleep when I woke up. Well, at least I think I woke up. And I thought it was a dream. I could hear a voice saying, stand to, here they come. I rolled out of bed and I realized it wasn't a dream. Up the beach were running groups of shining figures coming out of the river with swords and spears running towards our camp. And they were chasing one of our officers. One chap with a sword was trying to cut his head off. And luckily, at this point, our second sentry, who was on duty, Captain David Bombhead, who was a descendant of Bombhead VC of Rorke's Drift, was on duty. And David saw this happening, brought up his 45 Smith & Wesson, and he shot the attacker through the chest, and that stopped the attack. All the others saw this happen and dressed back, and we managed to get into a defensive position and hold off the attackers. But meanwhile, on the bank, on the left-hand side, more people had appeared and began firing ancient muskets at us. So it was really quite a difficult situation. And I said to the naval officer, who was a very courageous chap. I said, would you mind climbing that thorn tree and get the radio aerial down, pack the radio up, get it in the boat and sail down between the two firing lines and we'll meet you at the end of the island shortly. Off he went. At the same time, these various sort of bullets and missiles were pouring over into the camp. So we managed to hold them off for some time. We didn't have a lot of ammunition. We'd not come to fight a fight. But what we did have were these mini flare launchers, which mountaineers and yachtsmen carry. So we fired these flares to try and set fire to the grass behind the attackers. But as it was getting towards dawn, I decided we had to go. And we went down to the corner of the island where the boats had now been assembled. I gave everyone their last minute instructions about arcs of fire and so on. And I was doing that when history instructor from Sandhurst, who was a civilian, came crawling over to me. And I said, are you all right, Dick? Yes, yes. I said, well, your arc of fire is from here to here. He said, John, there's something I feel I should raise at this juncture. I said, what is it, man? He said, I don't have a gun. So I gave him my pith helmet to hold and said, look after that. We then got into the boats and we went downstream as fast as we possibly could. It was pitch black. We could hear the roar of the cataract up in front of us. And we were using the two boats with engines to pull some of the others when we hit the cataract. One boat turned right over. The three men were thrown into the river. My boat with the engine was beginning to sink. I thought it had probably got a bullet through the bow or something. So my helmsman, Joe, said, I've got to cast the other boat off and go ashore. And with that, he did exactly that. And he backed our boat and we crashed with a bang into a sandbank. And I flew out with the impact. And I landed right beside something large and scaly, about 8 feet long. And I realized I'd almost sat on a crocodile. However, the crocodile went away and we were left sorting ourselves out. The one boat that had turned over went drifting downstream with its three men hanging onto it. And a little later, we got flashes of light of Morse code from downriver saying, okay, okay. So they had come ashore. Meanwhile, we tried to sort out the problems of our boats. And the mechanic who was with us came crawling over to me. And he said, you know the nut that holds the propeller onto the engine? I said, yes. He said, I've dropped it in the river. I said, you what? He said, yes, I've dropped it in the river. I said, well, how are we going to start the engine? He said, well, I'll glue the engine onto the propeller onto the engine. He said, give me 3 or 4 hours, I can do it. I said, in 3 or 4 hours, we shall all have squeaky voices. So we better do something else. So he made a shield with plastic bags around the propeller, glued it all on, and we waited until it got to first light. And then we set out downriver once again. And as the light came up, we got onto our radio, and by some electronic miracle, we got through to base. We said, on no account tell the emperor we've been attacked again. And at that point, Joe said to me, oh my God, look at this lot. And I turned round, and there I could see on the banks of the river regiments of crocodiles. They were lined up literally on parade. As they saw us, they began to slide into the river, some of them galloping in, and they came out towards us like torpedoes. The zoologist with us, who knew all about crocodiles, said, no, 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 don't shoot, don't shoot. They're just curious. I said, if you're wrong, my friend, I shall kick your backside out of the cloud in heaven. But the crocodiles came right out, came underneath the boat. We could feel them scraping on the underside, and they pulled alongside us. The geologist who was with us became rather fed up with this, so he picked up a sandbag of geological specimens and he hit the nearest crocodile over the head. The bag burst. The crocodile didn't take any notice at all, but eventually swam away, and we sailed on downriver. A little later, Joe said, "Oh my God, look at this!" And there was another problem across the river with these hippos. The Natural History Museum had said to us, on no account should you approach hippos with your boats, because black rubber boats might look a bit like female hippos, and you could be mistaken. And I said, "Well, when is the mating season?" And they said, "We're not sure, but perhaps you can tell us when you come back." But we managed to creep our way past the hippos and downriver. And then, to our joy, we saw this Royal Engineer salt boat coming upriver. It had come from the bridge some way down and was driven by Captain John Wilsey, who later went on to be the Commander-in-Chief in Britain, but he was then a captain in the Devon and Dorset. And they had come up to give us support. When they arrived, we found that they'd got no ammunition to spare. They had no food, and they were in just as bad a way as we were. We'd lost everything. So we got on the radio once again, and we said, "Send the Beaver with some supplies and some ammunition." And so the Beaver set out. John Wilsey put up a flare on the beach, and the Beaver came over. And because they had no parachutes left, they had to do a free drop. And they dropped what they had, which consisted of two packets of biscuits, a little ammunition, and a 5-gallon jar of whiskey. The whiskey was actually destined for an Ethiopian general as a gift, but our need was greater. But you know, we had a wonderful party of a packet of biscuits and 5 gallons of whiskey. Well, when we recovered from that, we decided that we had to set out and try and get home as fast as we could, heading downriver towards the Strafartak Bridge. So we formed a little flotilla with the big boat, with its engine now pulling us downstream, and we headed down towards the river, and indeed on towards the bridge called Strafartak. Once again, there were crocodiles, but there was no food. There were no fish, there were no birds to shoot or anything. And I kept looking at these crocodiles, and I said to the geologist, "I know that we're meant to be conserving crocodiles, but don't you think we could spare one?" And he said, "Oh, all right, if you insist." And so he was a very good shot, and he put up his rifle, and he shot the crocodile in about the only place you can to stop it diving into the river and getting away. And we went ashore, and I got the naval officer, who was very good at this sort of thing, to skin the crocodile. And because it was a small crocodile, it lived on fish. And so we ate the fish, the tail of the crocodile, which tasted a bit like poor quality cod. But, of course, we had no way of cooking it. So we had to get a tin lid and some engine oil, and we fried them in engine oil, which tasted pretty revolting. So that was the only meal we had for some days. And eventually we reached the end of the run, and we saw up in front of us the bridge at Strafartak. There was a tremendous welcome from the people there, who were rather relieved to see us. And I remember one of the, out of the crowd, a man rushed up to me and he said, "I'm from the Voice of God." And he was a radio reporter from a religious radio station. I thought it was rather appropriate. Before we had left Addis Ababa, we'd been told we must bring a gift for the emperor at the end. And I'd said, "What does he want?" And he said, "Well, he's got a chihuahua called Lulu, and Lulu wants a mate." So I called my wife in England and I said, "Darling, would you go out and buy a chihuahua as cheaply as possible?" So she bought Lulette, a little tiny chihuahua. It was sent out on a flight of Ethiopian Airlines. It was greeted by the Imperial bodyguard, carried on a cushion, handed to me. It smelt to high heaven, so I took it to the hotel and washed it. And then off we went into the palace, clutching roulette. To get into the presence of the emperor, you have to do it in a certain way. You have to bow three times, once at the door, once halfway up the carpet, and finally in front of the throne. Each person has to do this. And when you leave, by the way, you've got to be careful because you have to do it in reverse. And Haile Selassie has a number of, or he had a number of pet lions in the room. So your chances of tripping over a ruddy lion were quite high. But nevertheless, I managed to get in clutching Lulette on a cushion. And I went up to the emperor and said, "Your Imperial Majesty, please accept this gift." "Oh," he said, "it's wonderful. You couldn't have given me anything nicer." He spoke perfect English. And he gave the little dog a hug. And he actually kept that dog until he was murdered many years ago. But in fact, he then put her down on the carpet. And meanwhile, the male chihuahua came out from behind the curtain. And he got rather excited and started to sniff the little lady, who got even more excited and spent a penny right in the middle of the carpet. So the emperor said, "No matter, it shows she's at home in my empire." And with that, the little dog went and did something far worse behind the throne. The emperor then said, "Come into my garden. Come into my garden and see some of my other pets." And it was unfortunate that our lady manager had got that particular dress on that day. And so that came the end of the Blue Nile expedition. But out of it, first of all, came an enormous number of scientific papers and results, which everyone got very excited about. And then, of course, the army said, "You've got to form yourselves into an organization." And so the Scientific Exploration Society was founded, and it aims to bring together civilian and military explorers, which is done successfully ever since 1969. And I do hope, it's nice, I think there are one or two members in the audience, hope I shall see you afterwards. But indeed, if any of you want to join, when I'm up in Waterstones, we have details about how to join the SES and go on other expeditions. And in fact, this year, I shall be going out to Costa Rica, when my leg is better, to do work with the local people and rebuild a bridge on the national parks using recycled plastic from the waste on the beaches. And so there are lots of expeditions that the SES runs these days. All we're looking for is volunteers who don't mind running a few miles gently, say chasing a bus or something. So I look forward to seeing some of you in Waterstones. And other than that, I'll be happy to take some questions.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant, and all of us enjoyed it, I think. What time of year were you traveling?
August. We started in August and finished in October. It was actually the end of the dry season, and the end of the wet season, so we had maximum water over the rapids.
Could you tell me where you do have to shoot a crocodile so it doesn't dive?
Well, the only place I'm told by the zoologist is through the neck here. and you break the spinal cord, and that kills it stone dead. If you shoot it anywhere else, it'll jump into the water in agony, poor thing, and swim away and die, and you don't get it. So if you are desperate for food and you have to shoot a crocodile, shoot it just at the top of the neck here, but you need to be a good shot.
Perhaps my main memory, thank you very much for that wonderful talk, is the fact you survived on Mars bars. How did you avoid them melting?
How did you avoid the Mars bars from melting?
I don't think we did. I can't remember. They probably did melt, but they were sort of fairly well packed. The rest of the rations were sort of all mixed up together. And we had sardines with everything, and so we had sardines and Mars bars all mixed together.
How long was the expedition? How long were you away?
We were there for just under 2 months.
Why were the locals so aggressive towards you?
Well, they thought that we were flying the emperor's flag, and of course that was what we had to do in his country, and they regarded us possibly as tax inspectors, which is understandable why they would shoot at us. They were quite friendly when they held us hostage, and they were really quite apologetic. I think it was just simply they had a quarrel with the local government, and they saw us as a way of influencing the government to just wipe out this demand for this dastardly tax that they were being given.
So, having invented whitewater rafting, did you ever do any as a hobby afterwards?
Yes, well, we carried on with improving the boats. We, in fact, worked out a way of making them self-bailing, which was a great improvement on the ones we had in that film. And we then went on to tackle the Congo River, which was a massive expedition in the what was called the Zaire, but now the Congo. We also did a lot of work in South America, Asia, and everyone then took up this idea of whitewater rafting. So in a way, we became pioneers of this new sport.
Hi, thanks for the talk. You mentioned that you're going to go to Costa Rica to help build a bridge. Is there any contribution in your past expeditions that you're most proud of still?
Sorry. With reference to Costa Rica, is there anything in your past expeditions that you would like to take on? Going to Costa Rica.
In Costa Rica.
You're going to Costa Rica. Is there any lessons from past expeditions that you would take
on? Oh, yes. Keep a steady nerve. Well, Costa Rica is a much more gentle expedition. They don't have an army in Costa Rica, so it's a peaceful country. And I've been there many times before. They're mad keen on conservation. And of course, what we're doing is trying to help with the conservation by gathering up all this waste plastic and recycling it at a plant in San Jose into planks and so on, with which to build a footbridge into the national park at Cocovada on the Pacific side. So I think the real lesson is from previous expeditions like the Blue Nile, you suddenly realize how the world is being destroyed. And we've become very much conservation minded and also trying to help the local people. And for instance, in Costa Rica, we'd be taking dentists because one of the things that people cannot get in the wild is dental treatment. So we always take dentists with us. And we take with us little puppets, which we give to the children after they've had a tooth taken out. And we say, this is a puppet of an animal. Now you should have this, but you must protect the wildlife. And of course, the kids in the end come up to you and say, take out my tooth, I want a puppet.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. And I apologize for being a little late. So my question may be superfluous, namely, what distance did you travel? Did you produce a map on screen before I arrived?
Yes, it was about 400 miles. The expedition had started with, of course, the backing of the army, which you couldn't have done it without. And I remember when Haile Selassie first of all asked if we would go and explore his Blue Nile, it was rather like asking an average hill walker to climb Everest. I'd seen the river from a bridge, but that was all. But I rather dismissed the idea and hoped that the emperor would forget about it. But when I got back to England, my commander, General Sir Napier Crookenden, a formidable chap, sent for me and he said, we've had a letter from His Imperial Majesty, Haile Selassie, King of Kings, chosen lion of the tribe of Judah, and also, by the way, a field marshal in the British Army. And he said he wants his Blue Nile explored. I gather you've seen it. I said, yes, General. He said, what do you think of it? I said, well, it's full of crocodiles, hippos, bandits, landslides, rapids. Oh, stop it, he said, you'll mean negative. He said, I don't like negative officers. This is just the sort of challenge. There was no war at the time. Just the sort of challenge that the British Army needs. And so we shall do it from the Royal Military College of Science. And he said, we'll have a committee to run this. He said, I shall be chairman and you will be secretary. I see no need for anyone else. And so with the backing of this formidable general and the army, that was how the expedition was launched.
We haven't got time to hear about your career since you went down the Blue Nile, but could in a few sentences you tell us something about your life since then?
Well, I went on as a Royal Engineer, and I stayed on until I was 55, and at that point, life had rather changed because after the expedition on the Congo, we took a number of young people with us. It was the first time we'd done that. And after the expedition, they went around lecturing to schools and colleges and encouraging young people with a sort of Elizabethan spirit of adventure. The Prince of Wales, as he then was, heard about this and sent for me and said, if you can do this with two or three people, why can't you do it with 200 or 300? And so was born something called Operation Drake, which a few of you may remember. I know there are one or two members here today from it, which went around the world with a big sailing ship and carried out good works and work on land, work in the jungles, work with the environment, with over 400 young people. Halfway around the world, the Prince of Wales called up and he said, you can't stop now. You must make it bigger. You must make it 10 times the size. And so was born Operation Rally, which goes on to this day. And the army seconded me for 8 years in the army to run this with teams of soldiers and sailors and airmen. And that changed my life. And I went on doing that until I retired. And then the Scientific Exploration Society, of course, continued running expeditions. I've run a number of them. And at the moment, we produce bursaries to help other young people going on expeditions, doing worthwhile environmental, medical, or community aid projects. So really, I've switched from being a soldier into being an environmentalist and an explorer.
Thank you very much for that. I just felt I wanted to say that I first heard you talk when I was a very potential officer in 1976. In Catterick Garrison. And I just wanted to say that the spirit of your expedition and everything it showed helped sustain various unpleasant things that we all had to go through.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for being such an adventurous audience and joining us for the first talk of the day. Colonel, that was incredible. He's now going to navigate us all down to Waterstones to sign a copy of his book. So do pop by to say hello to this incredibly brave man. I'm sure we could be here all day asking questions, but thank you so much, Colonel. Join me in the final round of applause.
Thank you.